The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For decades, the power of women's hormone shifts has been unrecognized and underestimated. Most women have a lack of education when it comes to the endocrine system and how and why our hormones affect our minds, moods, and behaviors. Welcome to Holy Hormones, Honey, with your host, Leslie Carol Botha, sponsored by True Hope Incorporated. When women thrive, everyone thrives. That is True Hope. Now, here is your host, Leslie Botha.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. I am Leslie Carol Botha, your host. Are we mad in America? Well, yeah, our government is shut down. People are out of work, not getting paychecks, while Congress still cashes their checks. I'd say we're pretty upset over that one, but let me ask the question another way. Are we going mad in America? That is the million-dollar question. My guest today is Robert Whittaker. He is the author of four books, two of which describe the history of psychiatry. His first, Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and the Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill, was named by Discover Magazine as one of the best science books of 2002. His newest book on this topic, Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America, won the Investigative Reporters and Editors Book Award for the Best Investigative Journalism in 2010. His blog, which contains the writing of other esteemed professionals in this field, is madinamerica.com. The topic of today's episode is The Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. Whittaker poses the question, is it possible that the psychotropic drugs that were developed to address mental health issues are actually fueling the epidemic of mental illness? Let's look around. Every single massacre, mass killing of innocent victims in our country has been perpetrated by people, mostly men, with a history of mental illness and a cache of psychotropic drugs. In Anatomy of an Epidemic, Robert Whittaker asks why the number of adults and children disabled by mental illness skyrocketed over the past 50 years. According to his research in 1955, there were 355,000 adults in state and county mental hospitals with a psychiatric diagnosis. During the next three decades, the era of the first generation of psychiatric drugs, the number of disabled mentally ill rose to 1.25 million. According to government records, there are now more than 4 million people in the U.S. who receive a disability check because of a mental illness, and that number continues to soar. Every day, 850 adults and 250 children with a mental illness are added to the disability rolls. According to Whittaker, the astonishing increase in disability numbers raises the obvious question, and we said this already, could the widespread use of psych meds for one reason or another be fueling this epidemic? Has the psychopharmacological revolution failed consumers? Are we going mad in America? And that is the topic today. Robert Whittaker will be joining us in just a moment, but first, hormone news. And this featured post on my blog at holyhormones.com sadly ties in with this week's show topic. The title is Miriam Carey, How Did a Beautiful Woman End Up a Psychotic Victim? Of course, I am referring to last week's Capitol Hill shooting of this woman in a delusional state with a newborn baby in the back of her car. According to Miriam's family, she suffered from postpartum depression, and police found prescription medications in her apartment for bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Miriam was unarmed and yet gunned down for driving through barriers. Now her family is making national news headlines questioning the shooting of their daughter, who is mentally ill. Miriam prescribed psychotics, or the police acting out of high stress and anxiety, reacting without processing, quick to shoot, ask questions later, guilty before proven innocent? During my conversation with Robert prior to this interview, he reminded me of the Andrea Yates case, another example of a woman with postpartum depression and a history of mental illness who drowned her five young children born between 1994 and 2000 in a bathtub. Andrea was a beautiful young woman, a Houstonite, and she graduated from the University of Texas School of Nursing at Houston in 1986. Here's a short timeline. June 17, 1999, overdoses on trazodone, a medication used to treat depression, admitted to Methodist Hospital psychiatric unit, where she is diagnosed with a major depressive disorder. July 21st, 1999, admitted to Memorial Spring Shadows Glen for psychiatric treatment after she tries to kill herself with a knife. She is treated there as an inpatient and later an outpatient for 2 months and is prescribed Haldol. Spring 2001, she is admitted to Devereux, Texas Treatment Network for treatment of her mental illness. She is prescribed strong antipsychotic medications, including Haldol. June 4th, 2001, psychiatrist Mohammed Saheed discontinues Yates' prescription of Haldol. June 20th, 2001, Andrea Yates drowns her five children one by one in the bathtub at their home in Clear Lake, Texas. July 30th, she is indicted on 2 counts of capital murder and pleads not guilty by reason of insanity. Today, Andrea sits in the state mental health hospital. She was denied the right to go to church in 2012. She will be spending the rest of her life in an insane asylum, not unlike many women in the 18th and 19th centuries when their husbands had the power to lock their wives away for PMS, hysteria, postpartum depression, and scolding or constant nagging. So, what actually did fuel the mental illness of these two women? Robert Whitaker is here. Again, he is the author of the latest book, Anatomy of an Epidemic. He and I were chatting before the show, and I can't even get through this book. It is so compelling, Robert. The historical data on the rise of these psychotropic medicines just has my head spinning. Welcome to Holy Hormones, honey, and thank you for your time today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's an important topic.
How is it that after World War II, I was writing notes copiously, that 425,000 people were locked up in mental hospitals, horrid, inhumane conditions, neglected, suffering, naked, sitting in their own feces, just like the Nazi concentration camps? How did that happen?
Well, there is a historical story behind this, and it brings us to one of the darker eras of American history. And really what happened, going back to around 1900, America, the United States, and especially people at Ivy League schools, researchers and all, began pursuing what are called eugenic ideas and the science of eugenics. And this arose out of Darwinian ideas of that, you know, species evolve. And so the idea was that if you wanted to have a race or a population get better, that is, improve itself, you had to control who had children. And the idea was you would find those who had good genes to have children, and then you would also identify people in your population who had bad genes and prevent them from having children. So this starts around 1900, and one of the ideas, of course, once this begins to be popularized, is that people with mental illness, mental disorders, or whether, you know, struggling in some ways with their minds, have bad genes. They have a genetic defect, and you have to prevent them from having children. Now, we did so in the United States in 3 ways. First, we began passing laws preventing the, quote, insane from marrying. But eugenicists said, well, those laws really don't work because when the insane go to the local justice of the peace, they don't mark the box saying that they're insane. So since that didn't really work, the next step was, well, we need to sequester people. We need to put them in asylums and keep them there. And it's after this policy that you see this extraordinary rise in the number of people kept in institutions in the United States for mental illness. And I think we went from around 100,000 people around 1900, or maybe even like 85,000. And by, as you said, by the end of World War II, we were over 400,000. And the idea was people would go in and they would stay there, at least through their breeding years. So that was the second thing. And then the third thing we did to prevent people from being mentally ill from having children, we began sterilizing them. The first such sterilization, I think, happens in 1906. And then in 1927, the U.S. Supreme Court rules that such forced sterilizations are legal. So we had these eugenic ideas, and by the way, forced sterilization was actually the majority of Americans favored that in the 1930s. But once you have those ideas that certain people are basically a pox on your society or, you know, a drain on your society, one of the things you do is you stop putting in enough money to care for them in any sort of decent manner. Now, we did have the Depression in the 1930s, which, of course, made it difficult when states were poor. They were lacking funds. But nevertheless, you can even compare how we kept our prisoners, our people who had committed crimes in the 1930s, and looked how much we spent per day on them compared to how much we spent per person on days in people in mental hospitals. And we spent much less on those in mental hospitals. And that's why at the end of World War II, when all of a sudden the country was given through media instances, expose, a look at what the conditions in were in many of the state mental hospitals, we were rather shocked to find people naked, just really horrible conditions that, in fact, some people compared to the concentration camps that had just been liberated in Europe.
And yet, and you go on in your book to say that the nation started worrying about mental illness, and that during the war, 1.75 million men were found to be unfit for service. That's an astronomical figure.
Yeah, this really does change things. And actually, the National Institute of Mental Health, which is the federal agency that oversees, you know, mental health research in our country, is born after World War II. And I think the country was a little shocked by this. So people, you know, being drafted, men being drafted into World War II, they go through some sort of psychological evaluation. And as you said, many were seen as unfit for service. So that was one shocker. And I think what that identified is that there were a lot of people out in the community that were struggling in a lot of ways, say with depression, anxiety, or even, you know, some cases psychotic type ideas that had gone sort of unnoticed before. So that was one thing we learned through this process. Now, the other thing that did happen in World War II was, of course, many of those who saw combat, you know, then suffered from shell shock and difficulties as a result of being in combat. And so between the two, and they needed care as well coming back home after the end of World War II. So you add all these three things up, and it was after World War II our society said, we really need to rethink psychiatric care in this country. And one, we were embarrassed by our state mental hospitals. Two, we saw that there was an unrecognized problem in the form of all these men who were declared unfit. And then three, the other thing we saw in the men who went to war and then became sort of psychiatrically wounded, that was very much a there but for the grace of God go I. We saw in that group of men that, you know, severe mental problems or difficulties could happen to anybody if the situation were particularly stressful or difficult. And so we committed ourselves as a society to start enhancing our care, improving our care, expanding our care in the years after World War II.
So, and you say in your book that psychiatry emerged from the poorhouse, workhouse, jail to the medical professions. In 1946, the National Mental Health Act was passed. In 1994, the National Institute of Mental Health was formed, and that anxiety, depression required active therapy, and that they became medical problems and they needed medical care. Was that kind of the turning point here?
Yeah, no,
I know
so,
the
so
antibiotics had a role
in
this as
well.
No, this
is important. So one of the things, if you go back again, psychiatric care prior to the end of World War II, we had a smaller group of people that were in the mental hospitals. Now, some of them weren't there for reasons that there's some social reasons as well why we're there. But our idea was, okay, these are severely disturbed people. And the psychiatrists who ran those facilities in some ways were seen as superintendents as opposed to medical doctors. That was something of their role. But we did have Freudian ideas about psychiatric problems now entering the society. And Freud, of course, his big thing was, in fact, anxiety. And so now we began talking about anxiety as a type of mental disorder. And in terms of what you saw in the men who were declared unfit or who came back shell-shocked, and in some ways a lot of it was severe anxiety. So what you see coming out of World War II is it's a reconception of what it means to be mentally ill, and we're going to expand the boundaries beyond that sort of more narrow conception of people who are really quite mad, so to speak. Whether or not that's true is another question, but that was the conception. And now we're going to invite the walking wounded into psychiatry, as they're often referred to, or the neurotic patient. And before, the neurotic person was just seen as, well, you know, part of being anxious was part of being alive, that sort of thing. So this is the moment it starts to become pathologized a bit.
And there, this is a long, interesting history. And thank you for going over this and at least setting a foundation. I know we can go back even farther than that, but we'd never get through the show, and I'm already going to invite you back. When we come back, though, I want to talk about some of these social issues that you just mentioned that landed people in the insane asylums, and also some of the gender-specific issues. And then we will get on into looking at some of these drugs that kicked off the psychopharmacology revolution. And perhaps, Robert, can you even define mental illness for us?
I don't think so, but we'll talk about that when we come back.
Okay, let's go to break. You're listening to Holy Hormones, Honey, The Greatest Story Never Told. We'll be right back with Robert Whitaker, author of Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America. Thanks for joining us.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Are you taking medications for depression, anxiety, or hyperactivity? Are you one of the millions of people who have experienced negative side effects from your medication? Do you notice that you just don't feel like yourself? For decades, the nutrient therapy leaders at True Hope have helped tens of thousands of children and adults replace their medications with Empower Plus, an all-natural multivitamin and mineral complex clinically proven to fix the issues rather than cover them up. If you or someone you know is ready for a natural solution that works, go to www.truehope.com to learn more. 20 medical journal publications show that the Empower Plus formulation can replace harsh medications. Thousands of people taking all-natural Empower Plus are medication-free without a return of symptoms. Go to www.truehope.com or call 888-878-3467 to try a bottle of Empower Plus today. Type in offer code RADIO for 25% off your first order. Again, that's www.truehope.com or 888-878-3467.
Understanding your mind, mood, and hormone cycle is dedicated to all the women who have ever experienced a hormone fluctuation, to the generations of women who have died because they had forgotten the source of their being. The richly illustrated groundbreaking book, co-authored by Leslie Carroll Botha and H. Sandra Chevalier Batik, is the product of a 9-year project which represents the author's shared passion and unified purpose to provide women with the education they need to reclaim their bodies and their souls. Find the book today. Click the link on the radio show page.
Step into a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are tuned in to Holy Hormones, Honey, with Leslie Carroll Botha. To call into our program today, please dial 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to Leslie at holyhormones.com.
Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. The topic of today's episode is the astonishing rise of mental illness in America. And, of course, you cannot understand the problem unless you know the source from which the problem arrived. And that is what Robert Whittaker is doing. He is explaining, as we've taken this back to World War II, you know, sort of setting the stage for us to understand this psychopharmacological revolution that has possibly fueled a mental health illness epidemic in America. And yes, it's not just America. It is, of course, global. But we are right here in our own country, and I know you, as well as I, are starting to question the mind thought of politicians. We're looking around in our families, our friends, and going, what's going on? It used to be that we could go out for a cup of coffee and have a nice chat with a girlfriend, and now it's just hearing drama and trauma. What is going on in America? We're not going to get through all of that today, but we're going to start posing the questions, and we'll keep asking those questions until we're all resolved. But Robert, thank you for joining us once again. You hit on some social issues as we were looking at the, you know, around World War II, the Depression, and certainly, as I mentioned, the 18th, 19th century when men and mostly women were locked away and their husbands had the right to throw away the key. So what are some of the social issues around mental illness back in those times?
Well, sure. If you go back to the 1900s, or the 1800s, the 19th century, when it wasn't so easy to get divorced, one of the ways that men did get rid of their wives was stash them away in mental institutions. And you know, you could have your wife committed basically on the, in many places, on the word of the husband. And there, this really brings up a larger subject, and that is this. So often mental illness is defined as by a group of people who see others as different and then basically want them removed from society. And there's even, you know, a lot of studies on this is in terms of how diagnosis is sometimes reflected in, so you, let's say you have white men doing a diagnosis. And if they're presented with certain symptoms that are exactly the same, and but then in this, you know, test or experiment, they'll just change one factor when they present this information to the doctors. They'll say either it's a black man, black woman, white man, white woman. And invariably, if it's with white psychiatrists, white male psychiatrists, they're more likely to give the black man a very severe diagnosis. Then goes black woman, then white woman, and then the least severe diagnosis is to the white man. Just showing that the diagnosis itself is variable and tends to become more severe as the person is more different from the person doing the diagnosis. And, you know, with women today, you have borderline personality disorder for a long time, which really was given, which was a diagnosis given much more to women than to men. So anyway, if we go back to the 1800s, we do see mental hospitals serving as a place where sometimes women, wives, were put by their husbands as a way, frankly, to get out of bad marriages. Then if we go forward into that eugenics era we were talking about, in a lot of ways that was fueled by immigration. So we had been a very, you know, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture. Then in the 1800s, especially the second half, we get a lot of people coming from, you know, Ireland, Southern European nations, Jews, Gypsy—I mean, just people of a sort of a different background. And when you look at who got put into mental hospitals in the first part of the 20th century, the first part of the 1900s, it often was people, you know, either people, you know, African Americans, or it was new immigrants, the Irish, that sort of thing. And there was definitely a sense that people with different customs and different cultures were more likely to be identified as the other and as someone not behaving correctly or within the bounds of propriety, you know, of correctness that we found acceptable. So there's always been this element of social control and involved in psychiatry, and where behaviors different from those who are doing the judging come to be seen as mental illness. So it's this mix. Now, sometimes people, in fact, really are just Yeah, they're very paranoid. They're hearing voices, that sort of thing. There's really something fundamentally wrong, and those are the people who are getting committed. But there's this other element of social control, gender control that runs through the history as well.
Well, and I have to suggest and add to that, and I've said this before in the show, that hysteria and women's hormone cycles dates all the way back to the time of Aristotle, and that femaleness in and of itself is considered to be a mental illness that needs to be managed and treated. That has been an underlying theory now that has lasted for centuries and has placed women at a great disadvantage.
Right. Well, that's a definition basically conjured up by men who are saying that.
You think?
Yeah, I do think. But
I think you're
exactly
right.
What I'm talking about.
Men
might
women
make
would have pulled that one off.
Mental illness than women would.
Yeah, right, exactly. But yes, well, that is what is done when you have one gender rank higher than the other. It is the suppression of one over the other, farthest from a partnership, obviously, and certainly the reason for domestic violence and so many of these other issues. And I say to women over and over again these days, Robert, this is not our reality. This is not what we would have created if we were in control, right?
I think women-led societies would be quite different, that's for sure.
I think so. We should at least give it a chance anyway. Yeah. But let's go back to this, because we had the birth of the psychopharmacological revolution came with the advent of the use of antibiotics. And then there were antipsychotics and anti-anxieties and antidepressants. And that led into major and minor tranquilizers.
I think we have to understand. So the common wisdom is that Thorazine, or a drug called chlorpromazine, which was marketed as Thorazine, arrives in asylum medicine in 1955, and that kicks off this great psychopharmacological revolution, this great leap forward. And we remember these new drugs as antipsychotics or antidepressants, and you can hear in that language antipsychotic an echo of antibiotics, as if it's fixing some known pathology. And what happens if you go into the discovery, say, of Thorazine and the first antidepressants and the first anti-anxiety agents, they did not come out of research into psychiatric patients. In fact, what happened is you had research in which researchers were looking for magic bullets like antibiotics for other diseases. So we knew that antibiotics, for example, were effective against gram-positive bacteria. Well, how about gram-negative bacteria? Well, they were looking for a magic bullet for that, and as they're doing that research, they find a drug in animals that makes them unable to, like, mount an emotional response to the world. Well, that drug becomes your first anti-anxiety agent, in other words, because it prevents a normal emotional response. Thorazine actually arose out of, they initially were looking for a magic bullet against worm-borne illnesses. Then as they were looking for that magic bullet, they found one of their compounds acted like it as an anesthetic. It numbed the emotions and, again, numbed the response to the world. Well, that's the drug that becomes chlorpromazine. It was initially used in anesthesia.
So let's give an example here that you use in your book, Robert, because you say when you're on chlordiazepine,
right.
Excuse me if I said that wrong, it's like a car coming towards you. And you exhibit no fear.
Yes. So this was an example that was a statement made by one of the researchers to explain the effects of these first anti-anxiety agents, which really were muscle relaxants. Number one, you just had trouble even, getting up and running. But the other idea was that you couldn't marshal an emotional reaction to your world. And therefore, you wouldn't be anxious. And what one of the researchers said, yeah, you'd see this car coming at you, and maybe you would know to think to run, but you would feel no fear. And so that was it. It prevented you from mounting a normal emotional response to the world. And that's really what you see in all of these drugs. Well, in the antipsychotics, chlorpromazine, again, these are numbing agents. They make you not care about the world. And that was seen as their primary effects. Not that they were an antidote to psychosis, but just that you didn't care about anything anymore. So So and then finally, like, the antidepressants came out of drugs introduced for tuberculosis. So the point of this is these drugs did not enter in psychiatric medicine because they were developed for psychiatric patients. They were developed for uses in infectious medicine, and then they had side effects that were seen as useful for psychiatric patients.
Side effects that were seen as useful for psychiatric patients.
Exactly.
Explain that.
They were
that.
Introduced for their side effects into psychiatric medicine.
And go ahead.
Antipsychotics, for example, were likened to giving a chlorpromazine. It seemed like it caused the same effect as a frontal lobotomy did. That's why it gets introduced. It numbs people. It quiets people. When they did the anti-anxiety agents, they gave them to mice, and they found that, you could put them on an electrified floor, and they just wouldn't even, their hearts wouldn't even begin to race. So in other words, they didn't mount an emotional response to this sort of threatening environment. So yeah, it was because of their adverse effects.
All right, there's some more history here. And of course, these were all known as happy pills.
Well, the anti-anxiety agents were called, or sometimes I don't give a damn pills. That's what they sometimes market. I just don't care.
You don't, okay, all right. So in 1938, let's do some more history. The Food and Drug Cosmetics Act was passed.
Right.
And this, you had, and the pharmaceutical companies had to prove drugs as safe, but they didn't have to prove that they were effective.
Right. There was no requirement that the drug companies had to prove that the drugs were effective until 1962. That was the Kefauver Amendment. So up to that point, they just really had to show that they weren't too toxic. And the first generation of psychiatric drugs, in fact, all came to market before the 1962 amendment.
In 1957, $1 billion was made on the stock market. Pharma was the darling of Wall Street with their wonder drugs. So how many people bought into psychopharmacology? According to Robert Whitaker, in 1967, one in three Americans filled a prescription for a psychotic medication. And I guess in 1967, that was $692 million in sales.
Right.
One in three
for a psychotic
American
medication.
Adults.
Right. Yeah, this is not my data. This is data, obviously, that was reported at the time.
Absolutely, yes.
And one of the reasons is, think about it, it's Valium that's so important. So the drugs that become real popular in the 1960s are the benzodiazepines, and Valium and Librium, and, they were described as mama's little helper. So they became real, real popular in the 60s. That's one of the things that was being fueled so much. Now, of course, in the 70s, as 70s start to come to a close, we start hearing about how these, Valium can cause dependence. People can become addicted to it. I think it was Betty Ford who had to go to a rehab center.
Mm-hmm.
So drugs so often, they become popular, and then we don't see the negative effects until later.
It's very interesting. Let's go back to the chlorazepine.
Yep.
That was tested on less than 150. No, that was Thorazine. Excuse me. Tested on less than 150 psychiatric patients. Called a miracle pill, and the testing was done on 150 people. Is that common?
Well, at that time, sure. Again, you didn't. You just had to prove that your drug was not going to kill somebody. So, the amount of information you needed to provide the FDA in the 1950s was quite minimal. Basically, it was just really, that you weren't going to kill the person in 6 weeks.
I read in your book that one of these drugs actually came from chemical dyes that were used?
Oh, well, in essence, so much of the drug industry comes from chemical dyes. But yeah, chlorpromazine came from a chemical dye first, synthesized in the late 1890s, I think, is when it was first synthesized. And here's the thing about magic bullets. I mean, penicillin's different, but other ideas about magic bullets, the idea was you could synthesize a chemical that, in fact, was toxic to the living organism. And the idea of a magic bullet is that it would only bind with, let's say, the invading virus or the invading bacteria, kill that organism, but because of the makeup of our cells, it would be inert with our own cells. That was the magic bullet part. It wouldn't interact with human cells, but it would, let's say, with bacterial or a viral cells. So that was the idea with dyes. You'd synthesize these dyes, make sort of variations of it, and see if it would hook on with receptors of, say, bacteria or viral infections. And if so, you thought maybe you had a magic bullet. And that's the beginning of the drug industry. And certainly, you know, antipsychotics trace their roots back to synthetic dyes.
Synthetic dyes, and you also mentioned one, and I'm looking through my notes, rocket fuel.
Yeah, so where did we get our first antidepressants? It was the Germans had invented, in the close of that war, they were worried about running out of conventional fuels, and they invented these compounds called the hydrazine compounds. So the war ends, and the Allies swoop in and want to look at these chemicals, and they began investigating the hydrazine compounds for their magic bullet properties. They tested one on TB patients, tuberculosis patients, and the first TB drug actually came from those hydrazine compounds. Now, they give them to the tuberculosis patients, and they notice that some of these patients sort of become roused. They become almost manic. So because this drug also caused this arousal mechanism or this mania mechanism, researchers said, oh, well, maybe that'll be used for rousing depressed patients. So, again, the first antidepressants come in because they are seen as causing this adverse effect in tuberculosis patients.
All right. So, really, who really are the test patients in all of this? Isn't it the medical consumers? What are the long-term effects of these drugs? Was that ever tested? The pharmaceutical geniuses of the time felt that they were adding to human happiness and achievements and to the dignity of man, and that the first generation drug agents actually perturbed normal brain function. And this is what stopped me dead in my tracks from getting further in your book, Robert, when you state that long-term outcomes of these medications use could be problematic. And we're going to be talking about all of that when we come back after break. Stay with us. This is Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Understanding your mind, mood, and hormone cycle is dedicated to all the women who have ever experienced a hormone fluctuation, to the generations of women who have died because they had forgotten the source of their being. The richly illustrated groundbreaking book, co-authored by Leslie Carroll Botha and H. Sandra Chevalier Batik, is the product of a 9-year project which represents the author's shared passion and unified purpose to provide women with the education they need to reclaim their bodies and their souls. Find the book today. Click the link on the radio show page.
Are you taking medications for depression, anxiety, or hyperactivity? Are you one of the millions of people who have experienced negative side effects from your medication? Do you notice that you just don't feel like yourself? For decades, the nutrient therapy leaders at True Hope have helped tens of thousands of children and adults replace their medications with Empower Plus, an all-natural multivitamin and mineral complex clinically proven to fix the issues rather than cover them up. If you or someone you know is ready for a natural solution that works, go to www.truehope.com to learn more. 20 medical journal publications show that the Empower Plus formulation can replace harsh medications. Thousands of people taking all-natural Empower Plus are medication-free without a return of symptoms. Go to www.truehope.com or call 888-878-3467 to try a bottle of Empower Plus today. Type in offer code RADIO for 25% off your first order. Again, that's www.truehope.com or 888-878-3467.
You are tuned in to Holy Hormones, Honey, with Leslie Carroll Botha.
To call into our program today, please dial 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to Leslie@holyhormones.com. Now, back to the show.
And welcome back to Holy Hormones, Honey, the greatest story never told. And this is one of those stories. Anatomy of an epidemic. Mad in America. Understanding the history. How mental illness was treated. And how we got to having one in four Americans today still on psychotropic medications. Why we're putting children on psychotropic medications. Trying to manage a society based on the judgments of a few elite. Wow, that's powerful. But, I mean, really, according to the National Institute of Mental Health, mental disorders are common in the United States and internationally. An estimated 26.2% of Americans ages 18 and older, about one in four adults, suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder in a given year. That figure translates to 57.7 million people. I mean, those are phenomenal figures. And yet now, Robert poses in his book, what are the long-term outcomes from generations of psychotropic, psychopharmacological medications? We are the guinea pigs. We are now how many generations from this, the inception of psychotropic meds? Robert.
Yeah, well, we're now 50 years into this anyway, 55 years into the use of these drugs. Yeah, I think what the point here, and I think it's a point our society really needs to address, and I think, Anatomy of an Epidemic, this book I wrote, is helping to actually focus larger public attention on this question. You know, when we look at why drugs get approved, even since post-1962, what they have to do is they have to knock down the target symptom of the disorder a little bit better than placebo. So if it's depression and you have some way to sort of supposedly measure depression, if your drug beats placebo just a little bit, you get it approved. Now, this short-term efficacy is really minimal. I mean, you can run like five studies, and three of them can fail to show that your antidepressant beats placebo. But as long as you get two that do, your drug still gets approved. So, and you know, it just takes marginal short-term efficacy to get a drug approved. But what I was looking at is, well, what happens to people after 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years on these drugs? Because, of course, so many people, they start them and then they don't come off.
Well, they become addicted to them, don't they, Robert?
Yeah, exactly. So what we do know now is that these drugs, as you mentioned earlier, they perturb normal neurotransmitter function in the brain in some way. So let's say the popular SSRI antidepressant, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. So what that drug is doing, it's blocking the normal reuptake of serotonin from this gap between neurons. It stays there longer than normal, the serotonin does. And supposedly that's supposed to be good for you. But your brain, in response to that perturbation, it has all these incredible feedback loops. It starts saying, uh-oh, serotonin is staying too long in that gap between neurons. And so now it dials down its serotonergic machinery. In other words, the brain starts putting out less serotonin. And the neurons, the brain cells that receive the serotonergic message, actually decrease the density of their receptors for it, the number of receptors for it. So the irony is you go on an SSRI, which is supposed to up serotonergic activity, but over the long term, it actually causes your brain to go into a low serotonergic state. And now, as Steve Hyman, the director of the NIMH, said, is at the end of this process, the brain is now operating in a manner that is, quote, qualitatively and quantitatively different than normal. So these are abnormalizing agents. And unfortunately, what you find with this process is two things. You find that once the brain adjusts to the drug, well, then you can imagine that coming off becomes difficult because your brain has become accustomed to its presence. And so you will get all sorts of withdrawal symptoms that at least many people do, that make it difficult to come off. That's one thing. But even if you stay on, the evidence starts to show that people tend to they actually become more chronic in terms of the target symptom. They're more likely to suffer depression over the long term, more likely to suffer psychotic symptoms over the long term. That's one effect. The second effect is that, you know, these drugs can impair function in some way, so you'll see higher disability rates in medicated groups than unmedicated patients. So when the NIMH, for example, did a big study of depressed patients, they found that those who took antidepressants regularly in the 6-year study had like a 7 times higher disability rate than those who did not. With a recent schizophrenia study, we found the recovery rate was 8 times higher for those who stopped taking antipsychotic medications. Now, one quick thing. This is not a medical advice, forum for your listeners. I'm just saying this is part of the research that's out there that needs to be known and needs to help our society rethink this. So those are two problems you see with psychiatric drugs, more chronicity of the target symptom. You get to see higher disability rates. And then finally, sometimes psychiatric drugs can just induce new and more severe symptoms. And the most common instance of this is when people go on antidepressants, there's a percentage of people who will suffer a manic reaction in response to the antidepressant. And if you go back to the beginning of antidepressants and you think of those TB patients, you can understand why that is so. And once they have that manic episode, they'll get diagnosed with bipolar. And then the next thing you know, they're being put on 3 and 4 medications. So what you see in that literature is a pathway for creating disabled mental patients. You take someone with depression, which if treated without drugs would likely, and person just made changes in their environment and all, would likely clear up on its own after a certain period of time. Now you put that person on antidepressants, has a manic episode, now becomes bipolar, and now they're basically eligible to be on the disability.
Disability.
Bonus. Yeah, exactly. And that, it is bipolar patients, which is 100 times more common than it was 40 years ago, that is really driving the disability numbers.
And yet, what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, and what you said during one of the breaks, that we are actually creating bipolar disorder.
No question about it. So if you talk to doctors in 1970 and ask them how often they saw bipolar at that time was called manic depressive illness. They'd say, I saw maybe one manic depressive patient a year. The prevalence studies found that manic depressive illness at that time, about 1 in 5,000 adults would have an episode of manic depressive illness in any 1 year. Now we're 1 in 50 adults is said to be bipolar. That's a 100-fold increase. And if you look at how people became bipolar, you see this. There's a small group of people that it does just seem to develop in, okay? There's no obvious triggering factor in terms of other drug use. But in other people, it's use of illicit drugs, okay? In fact, marijuana, cocaine, hallucinogens, that can be one pathway. And then the second is prescribed drugs. It's stimulants and antidepressants. And then the final way we're creating bipolar is we've greatly expanded the definition of who's bipolar. So before manic depressive illness, you had to be hospitalized for depression, you had to be hospitalized for mania, and that's how you got the diagnosis. Now you don't have to be hospitalized for either of these two poles, and they also reduced the amount of time you needed to be, quote, manic before you were considered, bipolar. So this is, in a way, it's an iatrogenic illness. We have drugs that induce emotional instability, and that we've also expanded the boundaries of diagnosis, and next thing you know, you go from a disorder that occurred at 1 in 5,000 adults to 1 in 50 adults. So that's, we've clearly created this bipolar epidemic.
Well, like I'm thinking of other epidemics, ADHD, autism, all epidemics at this point in time. Are we going mad in America? Are we losing our minds? Robert, you want to answer that?
Well, ADHD is clearly a construct, so what happened is, it's in DSM-3, 1980, where they first say there's such a diagnosis as attention deficit disorder. And what does that mean? You're just identifying kids that squirm too much in their chairs in schools. Maybe they talk too much in class, make it difficult for teachers to sort of, manage that class. And we call that a mental illness. But there's no biological marker for it. There's no biological test. It literally, if you look at the symptoms are doesn't do well in the classroom. And maybe that means that sometimes the classrooms aren't all that great, you know? Sometimes it's
we sure developed a drug for it really fast, though, didn't we?
Yeah, well, then now that's the point. Once you have this seen as a disease, now you can give kids stimulants for the disease. And stimulants, what they do in children is they reduce the number of behavior responses to the environment. That's what they do. Whether or not you have ADHD, you know, if you have this behavior or not, they do this in all kids. So, yeah, it opens up a great market. And if you look at how that market was opened up, well, you see that the drug companies provided money to this supposed patient advocacy group called CHAD, and that was partially funded by drug companies. And once they fund these patient advocacy groups, it's a way to market the disease. So that's part of what's going on, too. We're taking more ordinary behaviors that used to be seen as just part of the spectrum of human behaviors, and we're calling them illnesses. And by doing so, we create markets for pharmaceutical companies. And that's a lot of the monetary impulse behind what's been going on. I mean, you said 26% of Americans have a mental illness. Well, yes and no. It's just because we've expanded the boundaries of mental illness, the psychiatry has, so broadly that 26% now fall into those boundaries. But are they real? Well, they're just constructs. They're not formed.
They're constructs. And that was the concern about the new DSM-5, because the controversy, the concern, and even, I mean, it's known as the psychiatrist's Bible guidelines for those of you not familiar with it, but even psychiatrists were up in arms because really every single behavioral trait is now classified as a mental illness in the just about. I'm exaggerating. Okay.
No, you're not too far off.
I'm not. Thank you.
Basically, if you're breathing, you're in a DSM.
Yeah.
But I mean, think about it. You have oppositional defiant disorder for two-year-olds. That's what we used to call temper tantrums, right?
Yep.
So you have that. Now you have this new thing. It used to be you couldn't be seen as suffering from major depression and mental illness if you lost a loved one and you were depressed 3 weeks later, grieving 3 weeks later. Now they've gotten rid of that. If you're still depressed 2 weeks after you've lost a husband or a child, you now qualify for major depressive disorder.
Robert Whitaker, we're going to have you come back. Thank you so much. Do you have a closing comment here?
No, I just want to say, well, thank you for bringing this to, you know, I think your audience's attention. And this concern that, because we're using these drugs so widely and we're using them in children, we really want to have evidence that we're helping people and helping those children, say, for example, grow up and thrive. And when you look at the science, it's just not there. And the science is telling us we should be doing something different.
And thank you very much. Great closing comment. And we're going to follow up on this conversation next Thursday, October 21st, for the next episode entitled Through the Looking Glass, Mental Wellness and Micronutrients. Yes, my guest will be Anthony Stefan of True Hope. He'll be returning. And now that we've had this conversation about mental illness, the psychopharmacology field, what it is doing and what it is not doing to America, I think we're ready to start looking through the looking glass and coming around to what we can do to improve our mental health as a country and certainly our mental health as a world. So join me next week, October 21st, when we'll be putting a positive spin on all of this, because certainly psychopharmacology has not been the magic bullet it has been portrayed to be. I'm Leslie Botha. I'll look forward to being with you next week. Thank you for joining us today. In the meantime, take care, everyone, and blessings.
Thanks for tuning in to Holy Hormones, Honey. Please join host Leslie Carol Botha again next Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Have a great and healthy week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.